Welcome to the Christian Romance Book Club podcast, powered by FamilyFiction.com and hosted by Erica Rodriguez Well. This show is for readers of all types of Christian romance fiction. Tune in every episode for updates and author interviews. Whether you love contemporary romance, romantic suspense, historical romance, or Amish romance. Want to talk Christian romance in between episodes? Join our private book club group on Facebook and visit our website at FamilyFiction.com. Join our family at Patreon.com/FamilyFiction and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And now for your host, Erica Rodriguez Well.
Welcome to the Christian Romance Book Club podcast. I'm Erica Rodriguez Well. Normally in this part of the show, I'd be telling you about this month's featured book, which we're reading inside the book club group on Facebook. However, since this is one of our pilot episodes, I'll use this time to tell you a little bit about Family Fiction. The premier news source for Christian fiction of all genres, in September 2020, Family Fiction celebrated its 10th anniversary since it released its first digital issue with author Karen Kingsbury on the cover. Over the years, Family Fiction has served as an important resource for helping consumers discover the best in Christian fiction. We have served readers through a monthly digital magazine, a weekly email newsletter, a comprehensive website, and beginning with this episode you're listening to right now, our new Christian Romance Book Club podcast. Family Fiction spotlights the breadth of Christian storytelling in novel form, including Amish fiction, historical, suspense, speculative, romance, contemporary, young adult, and children's titles, as well as Christian stories told through other media, such as comics, movies, and animation. We do this with timely news updates, up-to-date release lists, reviews, interviews, book trailers, and more. For more information, hop on over to FamilyFiction.com. And if you're interested in being a sponsor of one of our episodes, please email Ross at FamilyFiction.com. When we come back, I'll be talking with Christian romantic suspense author Colleen Coble.
This spot is where sponsored books are going to be mentioned. Are you an author or publisher? Do you wish I was talking about your book right now? Find out how to sponsor an episode of the Christian Romance Book Club podcast by emailing Ross at FamilyFiction.com.
My guest this episode is romantic suspense author Colleen Coble, who writes romantic mysteries because she loves to see justice prevail. A best-selling author, Colleen's novels have won or finaled in awards ranging from the Best Books of Indiana, the ACFW Carroll Award, the Romance Writers of America Rita, the Holt Medallion, the Daphne du Maurier, National Reader's Choice, and the Bookseller's Best. She has over 4 million books in print. And now my interview with Colleen Coble.
I'd like to welcome romantic suspense author Colleen Coble to the Family Fiction Christian Romance Podcast. Thank you and welcome, Colleen.
Oh, I'm excited to be here. It should be fun.
Yes. Okay, so we're going to just dive right in.
Okay.
Colleen Coble's Two Reasons to Run is the second book in her Pelican Harbor series. We find out in book one, Colleen, one little lie, that not only do Jane Hardy and her dad both serve as police chiefs, but prior to that, they're both escapees from a cult.
Yes.
And without Jane's mom, who chose to remain behind, what inspired the cult part of the story? That's pretty intense.
Yeah, and I've always been a little bit interested in cults. I don't know why. Probably because I grew up in the era of Jim Jones, and I was around, you know. Yeah, so I watched a documentary not very long ago, well, before I was starting that story, and I thought, you know, there someone would take a lot of baggage after leaving a cult. They would take a lot of baggage with them because of the twisted view of who God is and just so many things that are wrong. You know, how do you find your footing again? How do you find your way back to to what's true? You know, what's really, really true. And so that was, and after watching that, Jane was just kind of came to my head full blown, which doesn't happen very often. Usually there, you know, there's a process of thinking it through and finding my character, but I immediately saw her somehow. And she's small, you know, she's not very tall. So even being a police officer is quite a challenge for her because she just kind of discounted because of her size so often. And I just thought, oh, I like her. I've got to write about her. And so I thought about her a while before I ever put the story together. And then it came about.
Oh, that's really interesting, because if she's also diminutive in size.
Yes.
You know, she has the additional challenge of she becomes chief of police.
Yeah, she's appointed chief of police when her father retires, and she has to prove herself. So she has to prove herself both to be competent, and she's, you know, with her diminutive size, like you said, that she's proving herself in multiple ways.
Oh, absolutely. I'm wondering, do you explore how being part of the cult, did that impact Jane's dad and her in their decision to actually become police officers?
Yes. Her dad, readers will find out more about that in Three Missing Days, which is the conclusion that'll be out next spring. And her dad has a strong streak of justice, and he saw so many injustices happening in the cult that he finally couldn't take it anymore. And he kind of passed on that strong sense of justice to Jane. You know, she saw a lot of things she didn't like too. So it just kind of was hereditary almost.
Yeah. It's actually kind of neat how very often you'll find children of police officers becoming police officers. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. And I kind of wanted to follow that along. So that was fun.
How much does having been in the cult affect Jane's current behavior then, or her faith now? Do you explore that?
Absolutely. And in reality, that is why there are three books from Jane's point of view. Usually I write series that have different protagonists that are spinoffs from, maybe they're in a family, they're in a community or whatever, and they're spinoffs. But this particular issue was such a large issue for Jane to kind of come to grips with that she needed all three books. So they're all hers. There's just a lot of family issues to resolve and a lot of faith issues to resolve as she comes to really understand what true Christianity is, because it was so perverted in the cult.
Oh, wow. I like finding out that this is different from your usual.
My very first romantic mystery series was the Rock Harbor series, which readers still love. That the first one of those books came out in 2003, and I still get requests every day for more Rock Harbor novels. And that series was supposed to be three. There ended up being, with the novellas and all, I think there were six or seven. And readers still love that, but that series had one main character through it too. It was Bree and Cade. And since then, I've done only the spinoffs. And this is the first time since Rock Harbor that I've gone back to one main protagonist through all three books.
Oh, wow. I like that it's such an intense exploration.
It's been fun to write. It's really been an enjoyable series for me.
So how deeply do you research for your novels? Because now you have cults, you have the police.
Yep.
How deeply do you research for your
Very
novels?
Deeply.
And what's your process?
Yeah, I always go to the location, because there's things that you just can't know, until you're really there. And I just read tons and tons of nonfiction books and articles online and all types of things like that in all the various subplots that I'm following. And, I always have to research the protagonist's profession. That's a constant pretty much anytime I'm starting a new book. And just lots of little things, the nature stuff around, the types of houses, the history, because that has to do with, what is going on there in the area too, is the history too. So I really immerse myself in research for the first couple of months and then plunge in and start writing.
It's exciting in a thoroughness that you go through that. I love that you actually visit the locations.
Yeah.
I think that does color so much of what the characters experience. And it
when,
can
we, when
extra.
I was researching the Rock Harbor novels, the second book, Beyond a Doubt, was set in the winter up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is, right there on Lake Superior, super cold. And we were up there on one of the coldest days that they'd had in years. And if I hadn't gone there, I wouldn't have known that they have these little balls on the antennas of the cars so people can see the other cars coming around the snowbanks because the snow's so high.
Oh, wow.
And there's things like that you just don't know. And down in Gulf Shores, there's a lot of shrimp boats, and they pave the driveways with oyster shells. And there's things like that you don't really think about unless you're actually at the site where you're setting the book.
Oh, and it's those beautiful details that just add so much texture. Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's absolutely worth the trip.
Yes, it is.
So I have a question, because I noticed in book one, there's a 15-year interim between Jane and her dad's escape from the cult.
Yep.
And he retires at the beginning of book one. And then at the start of your second book, Two Reasons to Run, we find out that Jane now has a 15-year-old son.
Yep.
So is that mirroring of the 15-year span? Is that deliberate? Was that?
It is deliberate. And that started, in One Little Lie, because then readers will come to find out that Will was her son and she didn't even know he was still alive. She thought he was dead. So that's basically a little hint to readers. Okay, 15-year-old son, she's been gone 15 years. And so that was kind of the first little hint that I laid down in a rabbit trail for readers to maybe pick up on, that there might be something there, but most readers didn't realize it till a little bit later. But yeah, that was fun.
Yes, it's really intriguing, because wait a minute, this is a little too specific. That'll be fun to unravel. Oh, I love that about mysteries, the breadcrumbs that authors put on the trail for us to read. You have the two books out of the, is it going to be three, the
it's
trilogy?
Three. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah,
so there's already a whole lot going on between the first two books.
There is, and then there's lots more family stuff coming to a head in book three. So.
Oh, I love that. So you have already, just in the first two volumes, you have the mystery of Jane's mother, who's still possibly stuck in the cult. Yep. We have the mystery of that devastating lie the father has told. We have Jane's romantic interest with documentary filmmaker. Is it Reed Bechtel?
Reed Bechtel.
Mm-hmm. Bechtel, okay. Yes. And a later reunion with Jane's son, whose life gets threatened. And we're not even going into the whole, she thought he was dead, which is a little shocking.
Yeah. And then one of the popular tropes in romantic fiction is secret baby. And I turned it totally on its head here, because usually, the mother has the secret child and hasn't told the father, they've split up and she hasn't told him that she was pregnant and that kind of thing. Well, I got to thinking, what would happen? How could I bring that together? And that was super fun, because it was just unexpected and different, that the father has the secret child that she thought was dead. So
that's what's really intense, because it throws that on its head completely.
Yeah.
So, yeah. What? Did I read that right? How is that even possible? So that's a whole other layer of trust issues between Reed and Jane.
Yeah. And that's something that's taking three books really to get through too, because once you've been lied to, it's hard to get past is somebody lying to me again? And, Reed comes to town and doesn't tell her immediately about Will in the first book. So he's not sure, can she trust everything he says? And then there's another subplot that really ramps up and gets very interesting. And that is that when Reed finally left the cult, he got married and his wife disappeared and he had her declared dead, and she shows up again. So that puts an even bigger, different wrinkle into the whole relationship with Jane and between Jane and Reed. So, that's...
Should we trim that secret out? Should I leave it in? Is that okay?
Yeah, that starts in book one.
It starts in book one. So, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're good.
Okay. So I'm like, oh my goodness, this is way intense. Yeah,
all of those secrets, start coming out. And and then I've got to take three books to figure it all out and bring resolution to all of those subplots.
Oh, that's lovely. That's just the chock fullness of it. Really. Yeah. Did you find...
It's quite layered.
Yeah. Did you find any section of that was the most challenging to get into or maybe intriguing to get into?
That whole piece of figuring out Lauren, that's Reed's wife, that they thought was dead, figuring out the legalities of all of that, because she was declared dead, but then now here she is again. So what does that mean for his property? What does that mean for his relationships? Is he still married to her? So there, and it depends on what state they're in. So I ended up having their divorce in Nevada, which is a really murky state when that kind of thing is happening, because that just caused more problems.
Oh, no.
You got to torture your characters,
Yes, it seems like it would be quick, and yet it isn't.
Yeah, that's right. It is not so quick.
So there's way lots of pieces and research, because even like you just mentioned, state to state, you'll have slightly different rules when it comes to everything. So you really
I have a friend who, Kara Putman, who's also a romantic suspense novelist, and she's wonderful, and I love her. But she's an attorney. So I said, hey, what would happen in this situation? And she said, well, it depends on the state. And that's when I thought, oh dear, we might be in trouble here. And then she tossed me some ideas and mentioned Nevada. And I thought, oh yeah, let's really torture them even more.
That sounds like fun.
Fun.
Yeah, this is really blooming into quite a mystery, and I love the interlayers of relationship, because there's just so many pieces to resolve and just work on. Out of all of your characters that you have Jane, you have her dad, you have Reed, you have the son, did you have a character, maybe even one we haven't mentioned, that really surprised you the most when you were developing a story and writing it?
Well, actually, Will, the son, really kind of surprised me, because, you know, in my head, I just sort of think of 15-year-olds, they can be kind of temperamental and they can be a little bit challenging, you know, it just depends. But Will is just an awesome kid. Now, he sneaks out a few times and that kind of thing, but he's just one of these irrepressible, loving kids that you sometimes come across. And I kind of patterned him after our youth pastor at our church, actually. So he was... but he surprised me a lot of times with just his reactions and the way he talked. He was fun to write.
It's so interesting how the writing process becomes, you know, a way to meet and get to know these characters.
Yeah. Well, I am not a plotter. I'm a much more a seat of the pants writer. So the first 15,000 words are tough for me to get down, because I'm still kind of learning. I mean, I know their backgrounds and that kind of thing, but getting to really know them in a really deep and intimate way takes me 15,000 words usually. But then when I hit those first 15,000 words, then after that, it really starts to flow. So I usually lay down several rabbit trails. I usually don't even know who the villain is in my novels. I have several possibilities. And so then I see where the story takes me, and that makes it a lot more fun for me to write. You know, I have plotted out a few books just to try it, especially early on in my writing career. But I found that I really hated the writing then, because if I know what's going to happen, why write the book? You know, I want to be surprised too. I want to go on a journey of discovery, you know, to try to see what's going to really happen here.
Wow. That's really intense, because you know, by the time you're 15,000 words in, you're committed. You're really want to know these people.
Yeah. And I lay down several rabbit trails and red herrings, and then I see which one's real, you know, who really did this and why. And then I might have to go back and tweak a few things once that happens, but it just makes it more fun for me.
Oh, yeah. It just seems so much fun and so so lively and organic, you know?
Yeah, it really is fun, at least for me. And I know some writers can't do that. And I always say, there is no one right way to write. We all approach story from a totally different direction. Some writers have to have it plotted out, and that's okay. And some know even less than I do, and that's okay. And I'm a little different in how I even start a story, in that I have to have the setting first. And a lot of people, they have, you know, something else, the premise, the character first, but I first figure out the setting, because I have found that really informs the story in different ways, because the history, the culture in that area can really change the circumstances of the story in general. So I always do it that way. I know that's a little different, but that's just my process.
That's neat though, because so often you hear more, like you mentioned, of the, you know, you get a character, but you don't hear about place as often.
Yeah,
you know,
I've run across a handful of other authors who do it that way, but not very many. I'm kind of different that way.
Oh yeah. It's interesting how it becomes an inspiration. The place becomes almost a character in
it does.
Itself, you know.
Yeah, it really does. When I was writing Abomination, which has been retitled Haven of Swans, sorry, it took me a second, Haven of Swans, I had a character who was a ballet dancer. And I was researching the area where it was set in Rock Harbor area again, and ran across an article about how the trumpeter swan's habitat was being taken away by one of the other types of swans. I can't think now which one, whether swan it was, but anyway. And I thought, swans? and she's ballet dancer, Swan Lake. And so it just progressed. And a lot of times the setting will actually help me with the plot. So for example, in One Little Lie, the first book in the Pelican Harbor series, the idea for the first scene came, I was having dinner with some friends down there and their 15-year-old boy was working on a shrimp boat. And he just, in an offhand remark, said, "You wouldn't believe the stuff we bring up in the nets. We got washing machines and refrigerators and all types of things." And I just had this scene in my head of a body brought up in an appliance of some kind. So it had kind of evolved from there. You know, so even then the setting informed the plot.
Wow.
And even in Two Reasons to Run, you know, I've been down to the Gulf Shores area researching quite a bit, and there are all those oil platforms out in the Gulf. And I thought, gee, that would be really cool to come up with something that revolves around one of those. So again, you know, the setting is huge when it comes to plot for me.
Oh, that's great. It's really like, what do you have to play with?
Yeah. You really get a lot better layers when you're approaching it and pulling in stuff from that setting that couldn't happen anywhere else. I don't want you to be able to take one of my books, pick it up, and plop it in another setting and it work just as well. You know, it needs to really be specific to that place.
Oh, that's great. We get to go places with you and with the characters. And that's really part of the treat of reading a well.
That's what I like too. I mean, I'm a voracious reader. I'm always got a book in my hand reading. That's what I like too. I like to go somewhere in my novels.
Oh, I love that. I love that. So you write books that are Christian, that are romantic, and that are suspenseful. So you have three really different dynamics that all come into play.
Yeah.
Which of the three do you find the most challenging to write?
It would probably be the suspense part, because there are so many pieces that have to work, and there's so much research that goes into that. And the pacing has to be perfect. You know, a lot of people would think that with suspenseful things and fight scenes and that kind of thing, that they go by really fast. But in the high suspense part, you actually slow it down. And so the reader is experiencing every flutter of your heartbeat, every creak behind you that is a sound you don't recognize, you know, like, whoa, what is that? You want your reader to totally experience that with you. So you actually slow it down. So the pacing has to be perfect. And there's just a lot of things that go into writing suspense that can be challenging. You got to think it through and tweak it a little bit and make it perfect.
Yeah. Since the suspense is really intense, is there a challenge with writing about, you know, the crime and the danger and the jeopardy, you know, the bad people doing bad things? How do you write that, the bad stuff, without, you know, normalizing it, really?
Right. One of the things that I've, you know, I'm 68 now, and one of the things that I've realized through life is that we're one step away from being that bad person. You know, we take one step in the wrong direction, then another step, then another step. And before we know it, we can find ourselves doing something that we never dreamed we could do. So I think that that sin residing in our heart, and we recognize it that way. As Christians, we know what sin is, you know, so we recognize that, and we struggle with it ourselves. And it's a human thing, you know, that is, you know, we all have that capacity. We would like to think we don't, but I've just seen too many things over my years of somebody who just made one bad mistake, and then they didn't turn around and repent, they just continued down that wrong path until their life is nothing like they had thought that it might become. And, you know, that's sad. But I like to show that humanity in my villains, and how greed or lust or the desire for money, you know, all of those different things can pull us down a path that's the wrong. And it really just reinforces what the Bible tells us about you know, following the wrong direction and going in the wrong way and not putting God first. It can really lead us to a world of heartbreak.
It really is a kind of a way to see the danger in making the wrong choice.
Yeah, it really is. And that's a sad situation, but we could, you know, it's kind of a caution to all of us to pay attention. When we do make the wrong decision, turn around, you know, go the other way, go back.
If there's some way we could warn each other, you know, turn back, oh man, kind of thing. You know?
Right.
Out of the three, then, do you have a favorite?
As far as the type of romance, suspense.
Christian.
Yeah, I do. Christian part, I couldn't take out if I wanted to. It is too ingrained in me. It's coming from my worldview. So that's not really hard, because it is innate. It's how I look at the world. You know, I don't think I could write anything but a Christian novel. I just don't think it would be possible because, and honestly, it's that way with any author. You can pick up any book in the general market and read it, and you know where that author, where their worldview is. I mean, you just can. So, so my favorite part is the suspense, just because it is so challenging and it's like a puzzle and all the pieces have to fit. And I like to layer in so much of the character with that suspense, and the suspense part has to be playing into the character's fears as well. And, you know, so there's lots of layers and lots of pieces that have to fit perfectly, and that's fun.
Yeah, I like that it turned out that your favorite was also the most challenging, because it really speaks to your delight in writing. And that brings me a great joy to know that you enjoy the process so much and enjoy the crafting of the story and putting in so much.
I really love to write. You know, I don't know how many of your readers are familiar with the backstory of how I started to write, but I'd written my first story in like first or second grade, and it was about a horse that had twin colts, and the teacher praised it. It's so funny that I can remember that so well. And my dream was, wow, maybe I could have a book in the library someday. That was it. That was the full extent of it. Just a book in the library. And so I loved English and reading all through high school. And I thought someday, you know, I'd be a writer. And I got married at 19 and had our first baby at 21. And as we women often do, I kind of put my dreams on hold to raise our kids and that type of thing. And then, but that dream was always there. Once in a while, I take it off and I blow the dust off of it, you know, and think, oh, someday. Well, when I was 38, the oldest of my three younger brothers, Randy, he was 37, and he was killed in a freak lightning event. He was welding for a grain bin, or in a grain bin for a farmer friend, and a lightning storm blew up, and the lightning was still down the road, and the farmer yelled, Randy, get out of there. And when Randy didn't respond, he went in, and the lightning had traveled through the electrical cords and come through the welder he was using and had electrocuted him, and he you know, so did not survive. And that was a wake-up call for me that if I was ever going to follow my dream, when? And I said, okay, I'm ready to write, and I didn't know what to write. And as part of the grieving process, we went to Wyoming, where my brother had lived with his family for about 3 years, and we hadn't gotten out there while he was there. And standing on the parade ground at Fort Laramie, that first idea just dropped into my head, and I went home and I wrote that story. It was called Where Leads the Heart. Took me a year to write it, took me 6 more years to sell it. And so it was seven years total. So it's like God's number, 7, you know, so that was okay.
Yes, a perfect number.
Wow. So to be able to do what I have dreamed of doing since I was just a little girl is something I never take for granted. And it's a joy and a privilege that I never will get over. You know, I really love writing. I love creating those stories and the complexity of them and coming up with new ideas. And I was talking to my editor the other day, and she said, I suppose you have another idea. And I said, I always have ideas. She said, I know that about you.
Oh, that's lovely.
And honestly, you know, when my first book came out, the first place I went, I took a copy of the book to my library.
Oh,
now, of course,
so
they buy them all, but
that's so
initially
great.
I just had to make sure my library had a copy of my book.
I love that. That is wonderful. Try to get back to it, because I'm just
relishing. Sorry, I got you derailed, didn't
I? I know, but it's like in the best way, because the enthusiasm is really inspiring, and delightful is just, it sounds like, who uses the word delightful? But you know, it's just like, it brings me great joy to hear that.
And
I really hope that people, as they listen to the podcast, that they'll be able to feel that inspiration also and feel that enthusiasm, you know, because
that joy has never really dimmed. You know, I just really still love the creation of story and talking with readers. I love to hear from readers, and, you know, I get ideas even from readers. Sometimes they'll send me a story here or there, and it'll be the seed of something that starts somewhere, you know.
Oh, that's fun. Do you have a favorite way for your readers to, do you keep in contact with them?
Oh, yeah. I'm always talking to readers on Facebook, and I try to answer emails when I get them. And I, you know, Facebook and email both are my favorite ways. So I know some people are into Instagram. I'm not into pictures. Give me words. Just got to have my words.
Going back to that, the romantic and suspense and Christian angles of writing your books, do you find it, what are the challenges do you find being a Christian, having a Christian worldview, you want to make sure that you're getting that across in your books.
Yeah.
And then you're writing about romance, and there's like a people have the presupposition of what a romantic book should be like, but for this, you know, general market, it tends to be a little bit more explicit
than
graphic. Yes. Graphic is a good word.
Yeah. But I can't tell you how many readers I hear from that say, it's so great to be able to read a book that has a romantic plot in it that I don't feel like I have to take a shower afterwards. But you do have to balance that, because we are human, you know, and there is still temptation in any relationship. And so you want to be able to show a little bit of that without going, you know, into too far of a direction. But, you know, there is passion still, and you just can't show it. I mean, you have to show your characters doing the right thing, making the right choices. Sometimes they don't, and there's consequences.
Yes.
And so, you know, that's the main thing when you're writing a Christian romantic element in a story, is that you want the story to be real. But if you are going to write about a sin that happens, I haven't necessarily done that, but I've read some excellent books, you know, actual full on romance where perhaps the situation wasn't great, but there's consequences.
Yeah.
And so that's the main thing that you get across when you're writing something Christian, is that if your character is going to make the wrong choice, you want to show what the consequences are. And there are consequences to sin. There always are. And it can be something as simple as broken relationship and regret that way. Conviction of the Holy Spirit. You know, there's lots of different directions you can go with that, but there are consequences.
Mm. It's those consequences that make us as people just so uncomfortable having to scrutinize that. And so often we don't get, maybe we do get taught, but maybe we don't, it doesn't sink in that there really are consequences.
The Holy Spirit makes sure you hear it later, doesn't he though?
Yes, indeed. So what about Jane and Reed's relationship made you want to tell their story? This is a lot that they're going through together.
And as the story, you know, there are certain parts of that I did know ahead of time because they were in a cult together, and I knew that their marriage was arranged by the cult leaders, and that was actually Reed's father. So Jane is carrying a lot of baggage from all of that, but he always loved her. She was more doing what she was told to do. But so there's all of that that has to play out and be woven into the story as she realizes she really does love him. You know, and that takes some time through. Again, that's one of the reasons that the story had to have three books in it. There's just a lot to work out. And I loved the idea of a single man raising his son by himself to age 15. And then now we have, he's found his mother, and there's going to be changes in the relationship that are natural and normal, but still can be a little bit of a bump, a speed bump, so to speak. So there's just a lot in that whole relationship that was fun to write, because there's so many facets to it. And it was just, this whole series has just been amazingly fun to write.
Yeah. I love how you have the intensity of that relationship, and finding out that Reed was actually in the cult with them and how that changes their dynamic.
Uh-huh.
Oh my
goodness. They didn't come together very often, and he was quite a bit heavier when he was in the cult, and he was just a teenager too. And he had a full beard. So, you know, I had to lay down the groundwork for why she didn't immediately recognize him. You know, yes, it's been 15 years later, but there still needs to be some kind of change that would make it where she didn't necessarily, he felt vaguely familiar to her, but, you know, she didn't really recognize him as the man that she'd been married to in the cult.
Wow.
The boy she'd been married to, I guess I should say. So.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, that's a nice surprise, because, you know, when you're just reading like the back of the book to get familiar with the story, and you're thinking, oh, okay, so there's a documentarian, you know, kind of involved.
A lot more to it than that, isn't there?
Way more. How intense is that? That's amazing. So what are the themes that you are, I mean, we kind of touched on the actual happenings, but what are the themes then spiritually and relationship-wise that you're exploring through the Pelican Harbor series?
Well, one of the main themes was that whole thing that I was talking about where you take, you know, because the first book's titled One Little Lie. Well, what can one little lie do Where does that one little lie lead? And there are so many facets to that through all three books that all have to come out. And, you know, you think a little lie wouldn't totally derail your life, but it totally can. And so, you know, it was a exploration of how that one step, in this case, in the protagonist's life, not necessarily something that she even consciously, well, she didn't know anything about it, but that lie that was told to her, how it had ripples through all of her life, through everything. And then the other theme was just the theme of forgiveness, which often finds its way into my books, you know, because she's got to forgive her dad. She's got to forgive Reed. She has to forgive herself, because a lot of people that have been involved in cults, they blame themselves for being gullible, for swallowing, you know, what they were told, for not seeing the truth. So there's a lot of that type of thing that she's got to come all through. So that's forgiveness often finds its way in my books, because it's something that I believe in so deeply that if you can't forgive, it will really wreck your life. You know, you have to have a forgiving spirit and be able to let go of those grudges and, you know, get on with life.
Oh, absolutely. Because it'll eat you up from the inside.
It will. It totally will. I've seen it.
So what would you like your readers to take away after they've read the Pelican Harbor series?
I'd like them to just take a look at their own hearts, and is there any areas that they're holding a grudge, or they haven't let go of their past, some kind of guilt maybe that they haven't forgiven themselves for. You know, God doesn't want us to carry that burden. He wants to forgive it, and you forgive it and move on, and not let it hold you down.
Oh, absolutely. New life.
Yep. New life. Yep.
So good. Really exciting. We're only halfway through, because Two Reasons to Run will be out now. And then you'll have the third book will be out in March. I think it is. Three Missing Days.
Yep. Three Missing Days, which I just finished the editorial revisions on and just sent them to my editors. So that's my favorite part, by the way, of writing. You know, I love the freshness of actually getting the story down and then that kind of thing. But then my editors get it and they send me back a letter of, okay, we love this. We love this. This could be a little better if you did this or this. And how it feels to me on this side of it is that I've been an oxen trudging up a hill, and I know just over the crest of the hill, I'm pulling this big wagon, and I know just over the crest of the hill, there's a town, because I can just kind of see it a little bit in the fog. But then I get my editorial letter, and all of a sudden, I can see the church steeples, I can see the flower pots on the houses, I can see the kids playing basketball in the school parking lot or the school lot there. You know, there's so many details that I can see better when I get a little bit of help. And it's like there's two other oxen on either side of me all of a sudden, and we're trotting down the hill to the town, and I can see everything so much more clearly.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I love the editorial process. It's just my very favorite.
Oh, that's so good. And it feels good to work on it as a team.
It is. I'm very much a team player. Yeah. I love my team. I have the best team. I've just been so fortunate to be at Thomas Nelson all these years. Amy McConnell bought my first manuscript of my first romantic mystery, Without a Trace, which is the first book in that Rock Harbor series, in 2002. So we're not far off from 20 years there. So it's been 18 years so far. So
that's a good relationship. That's fantastic.
I've been there a long time. One time we were having an editorial meeting, and I looked around, and I'd been there longer than anybody else.
Oh my goodness.
But regardless of how that's happened, I have had an amazing team. Every single person that I've been privileged to work with has been wonderful to me.
That's such a blessing to have a good team.
I don't take it for granted, believe me.
That's huge. It's lovely to have a team that we can work with.
It totally is.
All right, so I'll circle back to what we said earlier. What is your favorite way to hear from your readers?
I love to hear from them on Facebook. We chat all the time. And I love email, of course. You can probably tell I'm a bit of an extrovert. So the writing part, the writing part can get lonesome sometimes. And so Facebook and email brighten up my day and make me feel connected. And I'm not here by myself. You know, somebody out there is actually reading my books and interacting with me, which I love. And of course, I love it when I'm doing a book signing or an event of some kind and readers come. You know, I love to be able to see them face to face and give them a hug and talk about, you know, all kinds of things.
Yeah, that's always good. Thank you so much, Colleen. This was lovely, and I'm so looking forward to getting this interview all in short.
Well, I'm so honored to be here with you, and I'm thankful that we got this little time to chat. It was super fun for me. Like I said, I'm an extrovert. I actually got to talk to somebody today.
That's so nice. Thank you. And so many authors are also shy. So it's very painful for them to do something like this, but it's so nice that you're friendly and like it.
Yeah, absolutely. Anytime.
Thank you. We will remember that. Thank you so much. So on behalf of all of the Family Fiction readers and listeners, thank you for your time.
Thank you for what you do for us.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Christian Romance Book Club podcast, brought to you by familyfiction.com and hosted by Erica Rodriguez Well. Are you an author or publisher? Find out how to sponsor the show by emailing ross@familyfiction.com. Join our private book club group on Facebook. Become a member of our family at patreon.com/familyfiction. And subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. That's it for this episode of the Christian Romance Book Club podcast. We'll see you again next time.